as we're talking about these four last things, death, judgment, heaven, and hell, something that you might want to pay attention to is the fact that the definitions that we use for describing some of these things are a lot different than sort of their common or scientific meaning. And I'll just give you one example up front. Medically speaking, death is determined by the combination of two factors, right? Stopping of the heart and no brain activity, right? Theologically, though, in the church, we're not scientists, so this is not our area of expertise. So that's not how we define death. Death is defined as the separation of the body from the soul. Okay, so when I mean death here, I'm not talking about, you know, when did they flatline. I mean, that may give you an indicator that there's a biological lapse there, which means that death has happened or is happening. But theologically, we're talking about the time when the body gets separated from the soul. Now, this is a very, very important point, because what happens, for example, if I get called to a dying person's home, and I get there, and they've already died. So the paramedics are already kind of wrapping up, and they're already called the morgue, okay, or the funeral house, and they're going to come and take the body away, etc., okay? So the question always becomes, as a priest, do I give that person last rites? All right, well, the general rule is something like this. If the body's still warm, then yes, because even though biologically they may be dead, theologically I don't know if they are. In other words, I don't know when their soul leaves their body. I mean, I don't know. So if I give them the sacraments and they're already really dead, then the sacraments have no effect because the sacraments are for the living. So I always give them the benefit that, you know, they might still, you know, the soul might still be in the body. So I might, you know, they might benefit from that, of course. They would benefit from that. If the body's already cold and it's been a while, you know, let's say they died early in the morning and I get called at 10 in the morning, you know, they've been dead for, you know, several hours here, then there's no need to perform last rites, okay? Then that's when I do, instead of last rites, we do a blessing over the body. Alright, so this is, this area here we're talking about is all in the creed, alright, and we're talking about, right, the resurrection of the dead and the life of the world to come, right, which is the 11th article of the creed. So I'm just going to write a few things up here just to help kind of elucidate what happens to us when we die. And again, I'm talking here theological death, okay, so please don't mistake this for biological death. Now, could biological death and theological death occur in one and the same moment? Sure. Why not? Okay? But they might not. And that's why there's that little window of the body still warm, okay, that I might still anoint or actually give the body, give the person last rites. Okay, so here's what happens at death. You and I are body-soul composites. Okay? At the moment of death, the body has died. Okay? Alright. So all that remains is the soul. No, so the body may remain here on earth, and so, you know, we'll talk about like a wake and a funeral. And afterwards, if you want to ask me about cremation, we can talk about that later, but that's not in the creed, so we're not going to talk about the cremation. We're not going to talk about cremation specifically unless you ask me later. Okay? So here we are left with the soul. Okay, now, what happens at this moment? At the moment of death, your soul goes before God for something called particular judgment. Okay? Now, particular judgment is the judgment of you, body and soul, in this life. This is what is typically described as going to meet St. Peter at the pearly gates. Okay? You'll hear about jokes like that. Okay? Alright, so. Alright, so this is particular judgment. And that's a moment when you will face God. Alright? And there will be one of three possible outcomes in your particular judgment. Okay? Now, for those of you who are Catholic, this hopefully is review. Okay? If you're Catholic and you don't know this. You're like, what? What do you mean? Okay, all right. What? They go, okay, this, I hope this isn't like, you know, upsetting anybody, okay? Heaven or hell or purgatory? Okay? All right. Now, so as you can see, I've already lined up all four topics of tonight. Death, judgment, heaven, and hell. All right, thank you very much. Have a good night. Okay, we're all done. Okay. All right, now, we'll talk about heaven and hell in a second. Purgatory, though, certainly gets our attention here as well. All right. Now, what God is going to do here is he's going to judge you based on the life you lived. If you die in a state of mortal sin, you're going to hell. That's the doctrine of the church. If you die in mortal sin, you're going to hell. Now, this is a very interesting question that comes up because it really kind of colors the way people think about their lives. But Father, what if I was really, 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 really good my whole life, but I died in a state of mortal sin? You're going to hell. Okay, it's not a credit system. Okay, it's okay. But Jesus, I have really good credit. Like I was like 920 last week. All right, all three agencies said I was awesome. Okay, now, so really, one of the most important graces to be praying for, and this is why preparation for death is so important, is the grace of a holy death and the grace of final perseverance to the end. Right? Now, why is that? Well, think about it. If you're an angel and your counterpart's a demon, and you work one for God and the other one for the devil, your business is to get recruits, to get business. Right? Well, at the moment of your death, right as you're dying, this is, I mean, the most important moment of your life. The most important moment of your life. Because whatever happens here will color what's going to happen for eternity. And I love that line from the movie Gladiator. You ever see that movie Gladiator with Russell Crowe, Maximus?
Yeah.
Right? Well, right before, you know the opening battle scene? It was really great cinematography, how they kind of just orchestrated that, you know, violence aside. But Russell Crowe says, as they, before they charge down the back of the hill, they charge down the hill behind the lines of their enemy, he says, what we do on earth echoes in eternity. Russell Crowe, the theologian. Pray for us. Okay? All right, it's true. Okay, what we do on earth echoes in eternity. Okay, so even Russell Crowe had it. Maximus knew. Okay? So, people get really upset by this because they say, but Father, they were such a nice person and they lived a really good life. Okay? Right? So you're telling me at the end, if you don't die free of mortal sin, you're going to hell?
Yep.
Now, I'm not saying that. I mean, the church is teaching that. I mean, it's not like this is the Father my God version of heaven, hell, and purgatory, okay? This is in the catechism. Okay? Now, let's think about mortal sin for a second. You're an enemy of God when you die in mortal sin. Maybe a passive one, maybe an active one, but you have committed a grave sin, which has divorced you from God momentarily. Okay? You've had sufficient reflection and intent of the will. It was seriously wrong, you knew it, and you did it anyway. Okay? Let's get, it takes us back to mortal sin. Okay, now, if that's where you are, that's where you're going. Now, remember, at this point, it's just your soul, not your body and soul, just because your body's here still, somewhere on this earth, okay, in whatever form it may take, like, you know, particles or in a casket, okay? And then your soul goes on to hell. Now, let's take the other option, heaven. Right? If you die in a state of perfection, you're going to heaven. Bada bing. Welcome aboard. Okay? Now, listen to the standard. A state of perfection. Okay. Which means that most of us are probably looking at this. There we go. Okay, so there we go. Okay? So, right? But now, you've been to funerals, right? And I've conducted many. I've done more funerals than weddings. Yep. I've done, that's probably as many baptisms as funerals. Okay? And what happens? times at funerals. Many times. Canonization. We know Aunt Shirley. She's already with God. Okay. Unless they've had a private revelation, I have no idea how they know that. Well, I know it in my heart. Oh, that's really nice. You know, let me cry a tear, and we'll have a little Celine Dion song played, and it'll be okay. Okay. All right. So, you know, but people, why do people do that? Well, because they want to be assured that their loved one's in heaven. I understand that. Okay. But they don't really know that. All right. So do you see how things have become so subjective with people? If I think it's true, therefore it must be true. All right. Well, whatever happened to the fact that, what if objectively speaking, you're wrong? You know, it's like if Joan and I were sitting on a plane at Dulles, we're flying out west, and she, in her heart, really feels like we're going to Seattle, but we're really going to L.A. I'm sorry to say, but 5.5 hours later, when we wake up on the west coast, we're really going to be in L.A. Okay, we're not going to be in Seattle. You see the subjectivity? Okay. Now, you know, that's why it's so important. I mean, one of the the spiritual works of mercy is to pray for the dead. 95% of the masses that we say here at the parish are not for the living. They're for the dead. Why do we need to say masses for the dead if they're in heaven? It does them no good. Why do people want masses said for their loved one? Well, because they need help. Why would they need help? Because they're not in heaven. People in heaven don't need our help. They don't. They should be helping us. Okay? Saying masses for the saints does them no good. Okay? The merits of the mass are applied to a soul that needs. So let's say John Paul II. He died in 2005. Coming up on 4 years ago. Can you believe that? It was 4 years ago. Pope Benedict's been pope now for almost 4 years. Quick, huh? I mean, I think it's been quick. All right. I remember the day Pope John Paul II died. Now, so Pope John Paul II dies, and I know we did in my parish where I was at the time. We said a mass. I just called 5 people. I said, call everyone you know and tell them we're having mass tonight at 7 o'clock at the parish. Just show up. Church was packed. I mean, within, you know, I think an hour, most of the parish knew. Emails went out, and boom, everyone was there in a few hours, and we had mass. And so there are literally thousands of masses being said for Pope John Paul II's soul. All right, so did Pope John Paul II spend any time in purgatory? Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. All right? So let's say he did, and all of these masses that are being applied for his soul have now released him from purgatory, probably within hours of all the masses being said, I suppose. So now all these masses continue to be said for weeks on end, because people are doing memorial services and different commemorations, right? So the merits of all those masses go for all those other souls in purgatory that need prayers. So one of the great benefits of a great saint like John Paul II, if he is a saint already, I'm just assuming he is, but I don't know that, if this is say he is, all right? If he's already in heaven and doesn't need our prayers, well, guess what? His death is cause for, who knows, millions of souls in purgatory to get to heaven. So can you imagine, like, Mother Teresa dies, right, 97, John Paul II dies in 2005. I mean, their deaths alone might have cleared out whole sections and shelves of purgatory. You see that? I mean, so there's this whole notion, too, that one's death has a cosmic effect in the world. It's not just their moment and their death and their family grieving. But there could be thousands of people affected in purgatory, thousands of souls in purgatory that could use their prayers. And the, you know, whatever masses are going up to God to ask for mercy upon this one. So, well, they're already in heaven. You know, this is the great mercy of the Blessed Mother, you know, and there she is as a mediatrix of all graces, the one who, you know, applies all the graces for Jesus, saying, okay, let's get these guys out of here. You know, so it's a really beautiful thing to think about one's death in that way. And even one's suffering. Like right now, in any nursing home anywhere in the United States, there are old people dying in nursing homes alone. Right? There are. I mean, I know there are. So one of the things that we try to tell our nursing home residents is to offer up their sufferings for the souls in purgatory or members of their family that need prayers, so that their sufferings can be meritorious for those who need prayers. See, so that suffering isn't just a curse, but it's actually redemptive. It's beautiful. Because you're actually assisting others because you suffer. But that's not the message of the world, right? The message says suffering's awful, avoid it at all costs, do anything it takes to get out of it, and if you have a low quality of life, then we might as well just pull the plug. I mean, that's kind of the gospel of the world. Okay, so the church is saying, no, Jesus hung on the cross for 3 hours. He could have shed one drop of blood and said the world is redeemed. And it would have been. He didn't have to suffer. He could have just said it. The world is redeemed starting, bam, now. It would have been so. He's God. He could have done that. Right, but by his own suffering, death, and resurrection, he's shown us the more perfect way. All right. Now, what about purgatory? And where does the church come up with purgatory? All right. Well, this is a good question. I think we went over this. Did we go over this at some point earlier? The course has been so long that I hope we went over this. But, okay, let's just talk about purgatory for just 1 second. I just want to talk about the scriptural basis for it, too, in case I didn't do this last time. Now, what's purgatory? It's a place of temporal punishment, so it's time-based, where you are purified of your past attachments to sin in this life, or you're making reparation for sins you've committed in this life. I think I remember talking about this in the context of, remember hitting the baseball through my living room window example? Okay, I'll give you an example. Let's say Will and Matt are in front of the rectory some spring day. Baseball season's already started in the Cactus and the Grapefruit League in Florida and Arizona, respectively. And they're hitting some pop flies out there in front of the rectory, right? So Matt hits a pop fly on Will's dare that he can't hit the rectory. And Matt says, oh, you watch. So he launches one, and it goes crashing through our breakfast nook. Now, I'm sitting there reading the paper on Sunday after Masses, trying to relax before the 5 o'clock Mass, okay? So here comes the baseball, bam, okay. Now, Will runs, okay? But Matt, because he's a Catholic, feels guilty. Okay, so he knows what to do, right? So he goes to the rectory, knocks on the door, okay? And he says, Father, sorry. Okay. So I grabbed the baseball. Said, is this yours? Yep. Was this an accident? Because that would matter, you know. And he'd say, nope. Will dared me. Said, where's Will? Well, he's long gone. Okay, we'll deal with him later. Okay. But he's long gone, and I did this. And I say, uh-huh, I'm sorry. And I said, Matt, I forgive you. And he says, okay, thanks. See you later. Whoa, 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 whoa. Not so fast, right? Matt, first you're going to clean up the glass that you broke, and then you're going to replace the glass you broke. He goes, well, Father, you know, the economy's tough, and I don't really have time in my schedule to be doing all that stuff. Can I pay it back in some other way? Well, let's see here. Father and I, you know, need our dry cleaning taken down to Fredericksburg, you know, every other week, and you could wash our car, and all right? All these different things. So Matt decides, you know, to pay us back in some way. That's purgatory. God forgave you. I forgave you in the analogy, but you still owe. Okay, that's a good way of thinking of purgatory. I owe for what I have done. So you know that whole notion of forgive and forget? God doesn't forgive. He forgives, but he doesn't forget. He's like Italian. Okay? He forgives, but he doesn't forget. Okay? And it's not because God's holding it over you. Now think about this. It's a good thing purgatory exists, because remember the standard I just put up there? Unless, in the system of heaven and hell only, the only people who go to heaven are those who die in a state of perfection. That means probably most people would never go to heaven. Purgatory actually gives you time beyond the grave to make restitution, so you can go to heaven. And see, this is what's so beautiful about purgatory. People like dread it. I'm like, listen, if I make it to purgatory, everyone in purgatory makes it to heaven eventually. You get out of there eventually. Okay? And when you're talking about three choices, and I know I ain't going to heaven straight off the bat because I did not die in a state of perfection, and my only other option's hell, I'll take purgatory. I mean, you want to take purgatory. So, okay, so here we are in the second book of Maccabees, in the end of the Jewish scriptures. By the way, This book was eliminated by the Protestants when they reformed the scriptures. Luther didn't like this book very much. See, because Luther denied that the Mass was a sacrifice. He said it was a Eucharistic meal. So it's no sacrificial language, the Lutheran communion service. And then Luther said, there's no way that the Mass helps souls get out of purgatory. In fact, there is no purgatory. Huh. Okay. So, second book of Maccabees, Jewish scriptures, cut. Okay? So this is what it says. Now listen to this story, because this is very important. I just want to give you a little bit of context to understand the story. This is actually from the rite of Christian burial. I use this at funerals all the time, because this is my lead in to talk about purgatory during the homily. Okay? So, see, I don't canonize people during funerals. Okay? If you want to be canonized, don't ask Father DiMartino to do your funeral. Okay. Now, so this is what the book of Maccabees... Now, I just want to just give you a little background so you know what this is all about. Judas Maccabeus was, other than King David, probably the single most dominant military genius of the Jews. He was the Jew responsible for kicking all of the foreign invaders out of the Holy Land and restoring the temple to its former glory, which hadn't been seen in almost 700 years. And he was a guerrilla fighter and phenomenally gifted and blessed by God. They would go up against insurmountable, 300 against 30,000, you know, are some of the stories. Okay, a lot of you guys here in the military, 300 versus 30,000, thinking, let's just try to negotiate terms of peace here. You know, we might get out of this alive, maybe. You know, we might be in jail for a while, but at least we don't get killed. Okay? But Judah said, we're going, because God said we're going to win. As long as we have faith, we're in. They did. Okay. So what happened was, Judas Maccabeus goes into battle against one of their chief enemies. Now what happened was, some of his men, because they were facing such insurmountable odds, lost faith that God would secure the victory for them. So they put on, under their armor, amulets or little necklaces of the enemy's god, the god they worshipped, thinking that, well, at least we'll be saved. Okay? All right. Well, anyway, the battle goes, and all of Judas Maccabeus' men live. And all the guys who betrayed were wearing the amulet of the other side's god, got killed. So what would happen after a battle, as you guys know, even in Civil War times they do that, I suppose they still do this today, so you don't leave any man on the battlefield, you bury him and give him the benefit of that. So they're taking off all the armor of all their fallen comrades, right? And what does Judas Maccabeus discover? Every single guy who got killed was wearing the amulet of the other side. God permitted them to fall because they were unfaithful to him. Uh-huh. Okay, so got that? That's the context. Okay, I have to say all of this in a funeral, by the way. Okay, people are like, what is he talking about? Military battles for my uncle died. Okay, but it sets it up. Okay, now, so this is the reading. This is Maccabees, 2 Maccabees 12, chapter 12. Judas, the ruler of Israel, Judas Maccabeus, not Judas who betrayed Jesus, it's Judas Maccabeus, the ruler of Israel, then took up a collection. See, he was a budding Catholic. Judas, the ruler of Israel, then took up a collection among all his soldiers amounting to 2,000 silver drachmas, which he sent to Jerusalem to provide for an expiatory sacrifice. Now, what does that mean? Offering sacrifice on behalf of the dead. In doing so, he acted in a very excellent and noble way, inasmuch as he had the resurrection of the dead in view. For if he were not expecting the fallen to rise again, it would have been useless and foolish to pray for them in death. But if he did this with a view to the splendid reward that awaits those who had gone to rest in godliness, it was a holy and pious thought. Thus, he made atonement for the dead, that they might be freed from this sin. Now, this is 200 years before Jesus, and already Judas Maccabeus, an Old Testament character of Jewish history, already is showing us hints of a place where people go after death to make atonement offering sacrifice, like we do for the Mass, for those who perhaps hadn't quite gotten to heaven. So the question, of course, that it's begging, of course, is that was it possible for these betrayers to finally go to heaven? Well, Judas thought so, and he thought, just in case it is, I'll offer sacrifice on their behalf. Okay? This is a holy and pious thought. Right? So that's some of the scriptural references for the existence of purgatory. Any questions so far? Okay. So there's your three options. Door number one, door number two, and door number three. Okay? Now, it's like I said, everyone in purgatory eventually goes to heaven. So, time goes on, and you're still dead, and your soul's in heaven, or in purgatory, or God forbid, but could be true, in hell. Alright? People do go there. Alright? Now, time rolls on, and we get to the end of the world. Okay. Now, has anyone been to Rome? Raise your hand. Okay, a number of you have been to Rome. Alright. Now, you've been to Rome, hopefully you went to the Sistine Chapel. If you go to Rome and you're Catholic and you go to, oh, Bud, Horan, disgrace, okay. Alright. If you go to Rome, I don't even care if you're Muslim, you should go to the Sistine Chapel because it's a magnificent piece of art, even if you don't believe any of the mysteries in the paintings. Okay, now, where's the Sistine Chapel? If you're looking at St. Peter's, it's behind it to the right. This is where we elect the popes. Okay, we have done so for about the last 600 years. And Michelangelo Buonarroti, he painted the ceiling. Yeah, it's a famous God and Adam, God giving life to Adam, the two fingers connecting, like the E.T. Yeah, okay. And then on the back wall is the Last Judgment. Okay? This is really one of the most phenomenal pieces of art in the world. It's huge, the Last Judgment. Okay. So, this is not particular judgment. Now we're getting into an area called Final Judgment. Alright. So this is the end of the world. And, you know, over time, people have tried to predict when this is going to be. Like, did anyone see in the news today the asteroid that missed us by a little bit? And that could be it. Yeah, I guess it could be it. But then again, I'm putting up against Jesus who said, you know, neither the day or the hour. Put my bet with Jesus, okay? So, at the final judgment, every body, not just everybody, but every body will be raised from the dead. This is why cemeteries are going to be very busy places, okay? Every body will be raised from the dead and reunited to their soul. Okay? And we will all take a glorified form to enjoy eternal bliss in heaven forever, body and soul, or to go to hell, body and soul. That's the doctrine of the resurrection of the dead. Every body will come out of... Now, do you see why for many years the church objected to cremation? You see that? I mean, automatically, if you think about the doctrine, you're like, no wonder. Okay, now, we'll talk about that later as to why the church does permit cremation. Okay? We'll get at it in a second. But, so that's the doctrine. So, you will be reunited with your body in a glorified state. Now, if you go to heaven, your body will experience the utmost glorification and pleasure you can't even imagine. I mean, St. Paul does remind us, eye has not seen, ear has not heard what God has prepared for those who love him. Okay? But you will, in the body alone, you will experience the greatest amount of pleasure imaginable. Forever. It's great. Woo! Okay? And in the soul, you will gaze upon God. Okay, with your eyes and your soul knowing that you're in his presence forever. Okay, and it's so much so that maybe a good way of thinking about it is that the vision of God will be so intense, so pleasurable, and so all-absorbing, you will not be able to gaze on anything else. tops of the tops of the tops, times 6.02 times 10 to the 23rd, Avogadro's number, right? See, I learned something in high school. Okay, now, take the exact opposite. Utmost torture of the five senses, and no hope that it'll ever end. That's hell. No God, no way. Forever. Okay, anyone want to go to confession? Okay, yeah. Everyone's like this. Okay. People are like, Father, this would be a good night to have the first confession. Okay. You're probably right. Okay. So, those are the two realities. Purgatory will cease to exist. There will be no purgation. So, if you die here on earth at the last judgment, and you are due all this time in purgatory, you got a great deal. Okay? It's like deathbed conversion. I baptized a guy 2 minutes before he died. Guy's going straight to heaven. I mean, I was with him till the very end, and I don't think he despaired at the end. I mean, I think he wanted to become Catholic. He loved Jesus, and he wanted to go to heaven. And then I baptized him, and boom, he was dead. I mean, that's a good deal. Okay? All right. So, that's the doctrine of the final judgment. Now, let me just go back to my role here. See, I've got to keep this all together every week. David Couch, you here? Kay, did you show up? Kay? Okay. Amy Kovats? Jordan? Marie and Morgan? Parizzi? And Jean? No? Okay. All right. So those are the four doctrines. Death, judgment, heaven, hell, purgatory, and final judgment. Now, I do want to talk about one other state of existence beyond this life called limbo. An infant limbo, and recent Vatican pronouncements on limbo. All right. All right. Now, in the Old Testament, even implied from the reading from Judas Maccabeus from the Book of Maccabees, there was a state of existence. In Greek, they would call it Hades. You know, sometimes you want to say, man, it's hotter than Hades in here. Okay? In Hebrew, Sheol. Okay? Hades and Sheol, they are the two words. This is the Greek and that's the Hebrew. And those places were considered, in the Jewish economy of salvation, thought to be places where people went who died, not as enemies of God, but it was this underworld. Okay, there was another place that they went. It was a place of the souls of the just. All right, so here's the conundrum the human person finds themselves after Adam and Eve, but before Calvary, which is quite a number of years. Okay, so I'm talking about Adam and Eve, after Adam and Eve, but before Jesus. What happened to all those souls, all those folks? I'm thinking of the prophets and the good kings and the judges and Moses and Noah, all these folks, okay, who died, but heaven's doors were closed, right? Because heaven's doors were closed after Adam and Eve until Jesus died on the cross. St. John the Baptist, St. Joseph, we got some big hitters in this room, huh? Right? I mean, this is in the minor leagues. This is big time. You know, Samuel, I mean, all the prophets, Isaiah, okay. All right, so all these people, right? Who knows, maybe St. Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist, she probably was dead before he, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know when, we don't have any timeline. Okay, so all these people, right? These are the souls of the just who died before the redemption. All right. This is where the church explains, based on, of course, the Jewish tradition of taking also from the Greek, Hades and Sheol, there was this place called limbo. They're waiting. All right? You know the phrase, I'm in limbo. That means I'm waiting. I'm not here, not there. Nothing's really settled. I'm just kind of in flux. Okay, now limbo is a state of natural happiness. Now, what does that mean? It's as happy as one could possibly be in this life. Which is pretty happy. It's a pretty good deal, right? I think a lot of people think heaven is going to be like limbo. Right? They think that, you know, but see, heaven's so much greater. Heaven's another dimension. Because you're existing on a plane where your soul and your body, now in a glorified state, are so conjoined and just so absorbed in God. It raises an interesting question too, before I get back to limbo. Many times when I'm dealing with widows and widowers, one of the questions they always want to ask me is, will I be reunited with my spouse in heaven? Okay, it's a fair question. Okay. And I tell them, well, inasmuch as that is part of your eternal beatitude, yes, assuming you're both there. Right, right? I mean, you can't be reunited with someone if they're not there. Okay? You see the canonization? Okay, see? That's why. It's so dangerous to canonize people because they just assume they're... Okay, so you have to be careful about that. All right, now. But I would say this. You know, Jesus speaks about this actually very explicitly in the scriptures in Matthew. You remember the story where the Pharisees asked Jesus, a man married... A woman married a man, and he died. And then he had six brothers. Now, at the resurrection of the dead, whose wife will he be? She be. Not he, she. Okay, that was a different class. Okay, what wife will she, whose wife will she be? Remember, she was married to seven brothers. Okay? So Jesus says, in the resurrection of the dead, there is no giving or taking in marriage. What does that mean? That's why you folks who are married, your vows end at death. That's why if I have a widow or a widower, I don't have to run an annulment for them if they want to remarry. Marriage ends at death. Now, I know all the love songs, our love is going to be forever. I mean, I know a lot of you are missing American Idol, so this is all you get, okay? All right? Our love is going to be forever. I'm like, come on. Okay, it's not going to be forever. Okay? All right. And again, it's really kind of anthropomorphizing heaven on human standards. All right? I had to explain this one time to a bunch of high school and college kids. And the only thing I could think of that really worked for them was at the time, Bud Light was running this ad. It was near the Super Bowl one year. And they were running this ad where they set up in the first 15 seconds, these lovers had been once together but then separated. And then years pass and they're on an island and they see each other across down the beach. And then the music starts playing and, you know, and they start running towards each other, right? Unrequited love, finally to be reunited, okay? Now, she's running at him, and he's running at her. But behind her is this huge vat of Bud Light, okay? So they're running towards each other, and right as they're supposed to hug and kiss, he just goes, whoop, and jumps into the Bud Light. Okay, and he was in heaven. Okay. So I said, let's not reduce heaven to merely a family reunion. Okay? Heaven is on a plane so beyond our understanding. Fine, if you're happy that your spouse is there, assuming they're there, or, you know, whatever, fine. But that is going to pale in comparison to the whole shamil. It's just going to be so much bigger than any single human relationship you had in this life. Now, that's really something, isn't it? Okay? Because, you know, they say blood is thicker than water, but not in heaven. All right? And I will just say, you know, you may have hints of this already in this life. Sometimes in your family, you may feel a little bit of like a black sheep in terms of your love for the faith. Okay? And maybe members of your family think you're like fanatical or too religious. Okay? So So you find yourself becoming closer to people in the parish or friends that you're friends not because of biology, but because of spiritual ties. And you feel closer to them, okay, because of your spiritual connection. You may not be related. So sometimes, many times today, it's very interesting with young adults when they're having kids. It used to be that you just always picked your brother or your sister or your cousin to be the godfather or godmother of the child. It's actually becoming increasingly more the case that young adults are not picking their siblings or their, but really their friends, because their friends are living their faith and their siblings are not. You see? Okay. That already gives us a hint of the communion of saints. Our friendship is going to be based a lot more closely than just mere blood ties, but really based in our spiritual connection in union with God. All right. So if you've already experienced that in your life, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Okay, now, let's get back to limbo for a second. All right, so we have this place called limbo, where all the souls of the just who died after Adam and Eve, but before Christ went. All right. So, when we say in the creed, okay, he descended into the dead, on the third day he rose again. All right? In the creed. He descended into the dead, and on the third day he rose again. Now what does that mean? All right? He descended into the dead. Now, he's already suffered, died, and was buried. He descended into the dead, on the third day he rose again. All right, now during those, this is going to go back to how we understand Jesus' death. This is a very important thing because, remember, Jesus is God and God has no beginning or no end, but yet Jesus died and Jesus is God. So can God die? Okay, see? Ooh, everyone's like going, Kimberly's like, ooh. Okay, that's, never thought of it like that. Okay, so here's Jesus Christ, true God, whoosh, okay, true God with a divine nature. He is a divine person. He's not a human person. He's a divine person. Always has been. No beginning, no end. Okay. In the fullness of time, he assumes human nature. Okay? Human nature means you have a human body and a human soul. With me so far? Okay. Hopefully you got that down. Okay? So, Jesus is on the cross and he dies. This cannot die. It's impossible. Divinity can't die. God can't die. Okay, but this can, the body. Okay, so his human soul, conjoined to his divine nature, goes to limbo. He descended into the dead. Limbo, that's the dead. Sometimes you hear it said, he descended into hell. Not hell with the pitchforks, but hell as in Hades, Sheol. That's what they mean. Okay, sometimes people say, oh, Jesus went down to have a chat with Satan, rub it in his face, taunt him, you know. No, okay, it's not what Jesus was doing. Okay, some people think that Jesus went to hell to stick it in Satan's face. See what I did? You know, no, okay. I don't know, it's like too much NFL has crept into the understanding of the faith. You know, they get a 15-yard penalty for excessive celebration, okay? All right. So, Jesus did not go to chat with Satan, okay? So he went to limbo. Now, one of my favorite pieces of iconography, a Greek icon, maybe I've shared this with you before. If I have, just forgive me. In the corner here are the three crosses of Calvary, okay? And down here is the abode of the dead, limbo. And in this, there's a gate here, okay? Okay, and it's opening. The gates, it's in the process of opening. And behind the gate are Adam and Eve, Noah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the 12 sons of Jacob, including Joseph, you know, the technicolor dream coat. Okay, the kings, the prophets, right? St. Joseph's in there. Right? And Jesus is swooping down, like he's like, what do you call that, when you jump out of a plane, skydiving. Like that skydiving, you know, he's like skydiving down there, and he's holding on to Adam and Eve's hands. Like I said, he's pulling them out. You know, and I mean, you got to imagine that when the original Good Friday happened, everyone in limbo was like, "Yahoo! Because this is it. We're good. It's like jailbreak." Okay, and they all went to heaven. Limbo ceased to exist. Okay, because the souls of the just finally could go to heaven. So can you imagine the euphoria in limbo when Christ died? Right? I mean, the victory that they, like, you know, we've been here for centuries waiting for this. I mean, you know, hopefully nobody said it's about time, because, you know, you should be grateful at this moment, you know, you shouldn't be complaining too much. But you see what I'm saying? You know, I was like, yes! You know, so they're okay, ecstatic. Okay, so that's, I don't have a picture of that. I'll look it up on the internet. Maybe some of you guys are web savvy can look that up. But anyway, it's Jesus releasing his souls from limbo. Okay. Now, let me talk a little bit about infant limbo, because that's a little bit different than this limbo. Okay. Now, recently, there was a Holy See, a Roman pronouncement. It was made by a commission of theologians that advises the Holy Father, but it's not necessarily definitively taught by the church yet. But I want to give you kind of the whole picture here. This is the Catechism of the Catholic Church. This book. Hopefully many of you have it. If you don't, and you want people to know what a good gift would be when you become Catholic in about a month, this would be a good book. Okay? It retails for about $25, hardback. Okay, now, in the Catechism was composed by Cardinal Ratzinger, now Pope Benedict XVI, and Archbishop Christoph Schönborn of Vienna, who's a cardinal himself. And Cardinal Ratzinger, who was to become our Pope, purposefully had infant limbo omitted from the Catechism. He didn't want it in there. Okay? Now why? Well, because it's something that's been under theological examination for a few centuries now. So let's get back to this, and I want to explain to you where this all came from. All right. St. Augustine, 4th century bishop in North Africa, a town called Hippo, H-I-P-P-O. He developed a doctrine, which a church adopted, called infant limbo. So what does it say? Okay. Children who die before baptism. All right, now, they haven't committed any actual sins, okay? They haven't chosen anything, but they still suffer the effects and the guilt of original sin. You see this? Okay, now, does this have pastoral implications? You bet. When parents miscarry, this becomes very important. This is a very important thing to know. In fact, I hope you guys really pay attention to this, because you can be a tremendous helper in the healing that a parent might have, or parents might have, over the loss of a child, especially miscarried, or children who die. Yeah, I mean, you know, children who die. I mean, just, you know, like a four-year-old, there's an accident or something like that, okay? Because that happens too. Okay. So Augustine developed this doctrine, which the church adopted, but never formally defined, called infant limbo. Now, what does infant limbo say? Infant limbo says that children who die before baptism, okay, so they still are guilty of original sin, but haven't chosen any actual sins. Well, they can't go to hell, because they haven't chosen anything bad. But they do, okay, by divine justice, have to, I say suffer the consequences, but I don't even know if suffering is the right word, or endure the consequences, because they have not been cleansed of original sin by baptism. Okay, now, there's a whole other class of people this might apply to. Aborted children. A lot of those. Okay? All right. So, you see, infant limbo respects the need for baptism to be cleansed from the effects of original sin, while acknowledging that the children themselves haven't committed any actual sins. Okay? See where the conundrum is? Okay? They haven't done anything wrong, but because they're children of Adam and Eve, by original sin, okay, they can't merit heaven. Okay, so infant limbo, Augustine said, seems to be the only place they could go, because it satisfies the requirements of both conditions, They're not in a state of perfection because they have original sin on their souls, okay? But at the same time, they haven't committed any actual sin, so they can't go to hell either, and they can't go to purgatory, because purgatory is only predicated upon your need to make reparation. They don't have to make reparation for anything. They haven't done anything. Okay. So this doctrine of infant limbo was, promoted by the church. It goes on for several years. Now, it's interesting because infant limbo, like the other limbo, is similar insofar as it's a state of complete, perfect, natural happiness. The only thing lacking in infant limbo is a vision of God that you would have in heaven. Okay. So, this idea continues in the church for centuries and centuries and centuries. Some people even argue in the 15th century that it became really kind of absorbed in as a doctrine of the church. Alright, so we get to Vatican II, and it's interesting how the framers of the documents of Vatican II in the 1960s put it. They said that we commend the souls of infants who died before baptism to the mercy of God. That's all it says. It mentions nothing of infant limbo. Okay? So, what shall we say? Now, recently, in the last year or two, there was this theological commission, and they talked about infant limbo. And they said that there is good reason to believe that infant limbo doesn't really exist after all. That these children just go straight to heaven. Because Jesus did say, after all, let the little children come to me and do not be a hindrance to them. Fine. So what is the official Catholic teaching on infant limbo? You are free to believe in it. You are free not to believe in it. Okay. Now, for some people, infant limbo actually is something they want to believe in for their child. Because they say, and there's no suffering in infant limbo, by the way. I mean, there's not even an iota of suffering. The only lack is you don't have entire heavenly bliss. That's the only lack. So there's a defect, in a way. But, at the same time, I was thinking just today about a state of perfect natural happiness. Boy, that'd be great. Just a state of natural happiness. Like, all of your bodily senses are fulfilled. It's good, It's fine. Okay. The only thing is you're not enjoying the complete vision of God. Right? Is it in part? Perhaps. Okay. So, if it helps you that infant limbo exists, good. You'd rather say, no, I'd rather think of my child in heaven, fine. That's it. That's the doctrine of infant limbo. So, it's interesting how the media reported it. It said, infant limbo no longer exists. Okay, that's not what the commission said. Okay? The commission said, there is good reason to believe it doesn't exist. But the commission, by the way, the commission's not the Pope. The only person who can say it doesn't exist is the Pope. Okay? And it's still left as an open-ended question. Right? Ultimately, these things obviously are mysteries, right? But you can see what Augustine was dealing with. He was dealing with these two realities, original sin and its consequences, and also the need to be in a state of perfection to enter into heaven. So he's kind of juggling those two things. Okay? So again, like I said, you're free to believe in it. You're free to say, no, I'd rather think of, my nephew who died, was miscarried some years ago. And I had a nephew who died miscarried. It's funny because the parents, my cousin and her husband are split. He likes to think of him in infant limbo. She likes to think of him in heaven. And it's not that he wishes for infant limbo on his son because he thinks it's a bad place. I mean, it's a really great place, actually. I mean, boy, sure beats purgatory. And definitely beats hell, right? Okay. So we can leave it at that. Okay. I think that's all I have, on the doctrine, and then we'll end here at 8:25. It's a miraculous end time for me. And then we'll take about a 5-minute break. We'll resume again at 8:30 if anyone wants to ask any questions. And the persons I do need to see, if you're here, although I don't think you are the Parizis, Morgan and Marie, and Jonathan McGuire, if you're here. Okie doke. All righty. God bless you all. Have a good night. Islam.